Welcome to a special episode of PageCast, recorded at the Open Book Festival, Cape Town's annual literary gathering, spotlighting South African writing within a global conversation. Enjoy.
Welcome to PageCast, a podcast from Jonathan Ball. My name is Dr. Marian Bao, and I am a literary critic with the Johannesburg Review of Books. I'm joined today by Sibokazi Jonas, the internationally renowned South African poet, playwright, and actor. Sibokazi has established herself as one of the preeminent poets and documenters of our national narrative in all of its complexity. Her debut collection, Weeping Becomes a River, was selected as one of Brittle Paper's notable African books of 2024 and is currently shortlisted for the prestigious UJ Prize. Congratulations for that, by the way. I hope you win. Sibokazi, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
So I want to begin by asking a question about form. And I think this book is an exercise for me in playing around with form because it goes between poetry, obviously, which you're known for, and other forms of expression, other kinds of ways of storytelling, in order to weave its story together. So my roundabout question is, what was the appeal for you of creating a collection that plays with these different forms of storytelling?
Well, I think because it was actually not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it felt safe to just go for the usual collection, right? Just list of poems, really. Mm-hmm. But I'm someone who's always intrigued by the idea of fusion, but also tension between forms. Mm-hmm. So in the work that I've already done before publishing the first collection, I've worked in film,
yeah.
I've worked in theatre, but at the heart of it was always poetry. So think about, what does poetry look like on the stage? What does poetry look like on the camera? And how you know, what are the considerations? What are the concessions? What are, you know, I love to watch forms almost fight for their place in those, because you think, okay, this is what theater demands, this is what film demands in order to tell a story.
Yeah.
And then you bring poetry and think, this is what verse demands. So how do those things work together? So it felt almost inevitable that in publishing my first collection, that would have to happen. And I followed the instinct, even though it felt a little bit difficult, because you think, how will it be eventually received? But I've always wanted to also honor Inzomi, this traditional form of storytelling. And I thought, why not take oral storytelling and put it on a page among poems and see what happens?
Yeah. You feed very well into my next question, because I was going to ask about Inzomi. How would we define that? Is that like a kind of like sort of myth-making or mythical storytelling?
Certainly. It's a traditional form of isiXhosa storytelling, but it's not just an isiXhosa form. So you've got Inganekwane in isiZulu, you've got Tsomo in Sesotho, for example. So it is, you know, heavily South African form of oral storytelling, sitting around a fire, grandmother, mother, telling stories, usually at the end of the day, because there was, it had a very specific sort of timing attached to it, that once everyone has done their task and ready to settle in for the evening, these are the stories. But they also carry lessons, they carry the value system of, you know, they deal with social issues as well, because it's a way to challenge maybe problems within a family, problems within a society, highly improvisational. However, they usually work around specific tropes, specific images, but the same person could tell a similar story in different ways using the same characters. The outcome is different. So you sometimes might find someone who grew up in Inzomi. You all know the same characters, but different things happen. And often the narrator will weave in the things that they want to say. So if, you know, the men in the village are being very troublesome, you can use Inzomi and see the outcome of that particular character. Using, you know, villainous characters, Igongong, the cannibal, is very significant. And in here, I decided Prospero would be the cannibal, which, of course, colonial cannibalization. So it, for me, it's something not necessarily around a fire. It was, my mom would tell us, in our parents' bedroom around a paraffin heater, you know, in bed, snuggled up and being told their stories. So it's played a significant role in my own formation. And I'm always looking for ways of bringing those. But here I was just unapologetic that it wouldn't just be inspiration. It would be, it would take center stage.
Yeah. I like that you bring in the cultural element of it, because I think for me, even if there were points where I wasn't quite as familiar with the specific locality of it, there was very definitely something about the form that I recognized and that I responded to on a, like, oh, this is, you know, the kind of story my mum told me, or this is a sort of, and that is an element of it that simultaneously feels both local, but also, you know, in a way that isn't necessarily very easy to achieve, also manages to be broadly African in a way, which is really, really good.
I'm really happy to hear that, because of course I was writing a new one, but it was borrowing from those particular tropes and some of the character arcs, or rather story arcs, and thinking about, you know, the significance of perhaps things happening in threes, the significance of songs, of chants, and what they do, how they drive the plot forward, the interact, you know, the idea of a protagonist that goes on a journey, a transformational journey, and then what it looks like to challenge even some of those tropes and to leave others as well, where I think some of the familiarity has to do with social constructs. So thinking about, okay, you know, there's the scene with the men in the crawl when they're waiting for the naming ceremony, for example, where I had to weigh, do I want to, you know, where do I want to place my mark, or where do I really feel I'm pushing this line a little bit. So where I left some things as familiar for the reader, but using this girl, a young girl, as a protagonist who goes on this particular journey while I'm challenging my own things and my own questions around Western forms of storytelling. It felt really, really wonderful. Even using poetry as, you know, so this is a thing actually.
I like that you're getting into it.
There's a thing happening here. Because, you know, it's the question of how to read the book. Because in essence, you could just read the story and follow the plot. You could just read the poetry.
But they speak to each other. Yeah, I see how you could kind of separate them, because you kind of start off and then it becomes something else and you're like, oh, okay, what's going on here? But they speak to each other in this wonderfully, you know, nestled way, and I found that really, really good.
I must also tell you, because this is a new thing that's happening, and I'm excitedly telling everyone about it. I've been recording the audiobook.
Excellent.
And I've realized that there are things that there are other connections that exist for the ear rather than the eye. There's a shift from this poem called Eastern Cape Mecca, and then it moves into the narration back into the story, and the poem ends with home. And the next part of the story starts with home. Or maybe actually the other way around. But I realized I wasn't aware of that in writing. And only when I was recording in studio and I was hearing it back, I was like, oh, goodness. But home means something different in the poem than it does in the story. So it's exciting. Adaptation for me offers those kinds of revelations, even to me as the writer.
I mean, it almost feels like it would be the natural follow-on, because I first came to your work in that kind of performed way. And so I inevitably, I hear your voice when I'm reading this, you know, which is very helpful. It's useful to have that sense of like, ah, yes, you know. So I would think that the audiobook would almost be the natural follow on from that.
Yes.
What has that process been like, you know, putting it into the world in that way?
Goodness. It is slowly coming into the world at the moment. So I'm really excited to hear, because I think again brings into prominence, or adds, I believe, what has been a wave and continuum of different writers, musicians, theater makers that have actually been digging in the archive of Intsomi. There was Utlaganyana that I believe had been staged in Johannesburg a little while back. One of the first people that I remember doing this kind of work with, Zoe Modiga, in two of her albums, she's looking at Inganekwane and this idea of Thosi. And so the call and response, the dialogical nature of oral storytelling that actually invites the audience in a very specific way. So I'm not starting anything new. I believe I'm adding to that particular body of water that's really moving. And so being able to record an audiobook, it just brings Intsomi in particular to life.
Yeah.
And I've been on this mission to say, you know, adults deserve story time. Just like kids.
I like that.
So I feel like if anyone comes to the audiobook, it's to expect a story time experience and hopefully just enjoy it and have feel the embodied parts of the story.
I don't want to ask a reductive question, especially because to ask sort of what this book is about is kind of to try to inevitably close off a lot of what you're doing here, but would you give us just a top line, no spoilers, of what is actually going on in the story? What is your narrative about? What does it concern?
The story is about a strange girl born under strange circumstances whose parents follow a certain ritual that, you know, holds the tension between her strangeness and possible ostracization and you know, follow this ritual that sort of tries to cover and hide that in order for her to be accepted within society.
Yeah.
But she is without a name because of that.
Yeah.
And something happens, as it always does in these stories, and she has to leave. Mm. She's forced to get out. And so she goes into a different world, you know, where she sort of has to work out her journey and become who she's supposed to be, technically. Mm. The transformation is both, it manifests in different ways, which is where she meets Prospero.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens there that then leads her back. But it is a very uneasy kind of, and it's not a resolution at all in terms of, you know, sort of coming home and
so
it is. You know, it's about the in-betweenness of her journey and moving from. I'm going to stop there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop there.
Okay. Let me
make
yourself. Yeah. I wonder, again, without leaning into, you know, giving away too much, something that I've always resonated with quite strongly in your work is this concern with language and how language finds its way into our mouths, you know, mm-hmm. often, you know, historically and also socially, you know, and we'll see it from various perspectives. And of course, the experience that I think many people, certainly in my generation, you know, you're a bit younger than me, but I know you're writing to the same thing, is that kind of the Model C, you know, thing and how, what that means in terms of, you know, our kind of cultural locatedness, what it means to exist sort of between two worlds and all of that. How does this book kind of touch on some of those themes?
I'd love to read a poem to you.
Mm, please.
I'd love to read a poem to you. And I think it sort of holds part of the heart of that inquiry for me. And it's Straining Cloth.
Mm-hmm.
After crucifying ubukhazabam, wounds dressed in school uniform, tongue bound for 6 hours to avoid detection and detention, then migrating home by bus to hydrate with ginger beer. I wish I'd asked the ground ginger dredged through a straining cloth how it felt to surrender the flavor of its body to a drink, then be discarded. Wars are won and lost with bodies. In former white schools, we were thorny as bones securing victory for Athens, breaking the architect of apartheid's curse over Bantu education in exchange for new accents, to finesse our way into white economy. Had I foreseen my excavation, a heap of ex-miners and domestic workers eroded to silicosis and arthritis, black employees code-switching daily, wounds dressed in traditional costume on Heritage Day. I would have been less annoyed by traces of ginger escaping a straining cloth to lurk at the bottom of my glass and in my throat.
Mm.
I think what's significant for me, and it had to do with even some of my concerns during my post-grad studies, was, so I speak about the Model C experience, but it is also tracing back. It's thinking back to Saul Blakey, for example, and translations of Shakespeare and thinking about, you know, the drum era, thinking about Lovedale Press. So it is, for me, there's a kind of continuum in that experience really draws back for a very long time. So I the excavation that I mentioned even here, where I'm thinking about migrant labor, thinking about, you know, bodies in particular as part of feeding this capitalist machine that, you know, as learners in the school, the same thing was happening. Yeah. So in the education system, the same thing has happened. So it's not an isolated experience that just has to do with language. As you said, it's a social web of things. So it's felt like that excavation in thinking about my own tensions, my own losses, my own gains. It's then thinking about my mother, it's thinking about my father, it's thinking about grandparents, it's going back for generations, what was accessible, what was not, how one navigates all of those places, because now when you're not proficient in your mother tongue, what do you not have access to anymore? When you have Englishness as an aspirational kind of tongue and social mobility and all of those things, but you know it goes back to the teaching of the Bible and Shakespeare with missionaries that came and so I feel like those things were questions I was asking when I was doing my master's many, many years ago. But it's been wonderful to actually bring some of those questions back in, hence Shakespeare's sort of occasional feature in the book.
Because I
felt like English education in particular has played a significant role when you say values in, you know, that are espoused in Shakespearean play, for example, or the idea of Shakespeare more than anything, and you say those are universal instead of those are British. Absolutely. Then you're trying to produce little, foot soldiers for empire, in essence. And so I've really been interested for a long time in that and what it means, because there's even you're trained to aspire to whiteness in a very specific way in those schools, even though they may not have the same demographics anymore. I had an experience recently where most of the girls in the school are black, but the school actually still holds that same legacy.
Yeah.
Right? It's still a white school. Under the surface.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's how those things really play out. And for me, it's about bodies. Hence, Olinde Ogutiwa's transformations, the fluidity or lack thereof of the body. It's very significant. And in South Africa, I mean, the labor issues continue.
Yeah. I think that, again, one of the things that makes this text resonate so strongly for me is that you're using the almost the tools of the mythic to tell a story that in one sense is very modern and feels very up to date. But exactly as you say, you're linking it to these, you know, these long histories of kind of interaction, you know, and often quite predatory interaction, of course, you know, talking about whiteness and its incursion in the world of, in the realm of blackness, but without centering whiteness in that story is quite a tricky thing to do. And I think you manage that really well.
Thank you. Thank you. I also want to credit my my editor, Uvangile Kanju. I've become goodness. She really asked such significant questions of me in the early process, which changed the writing, because the question was, she asked me, who do you write for? And then she said, okay, because you keep translating yourself. And so, I may say I'm writing for, you know, others like me, other so-called, you know, coconuts in recovery. Right. And then she said, because you keep translating yourself. And so I think that betrayed who was in my mind, who my inherent or imagined reader is. And that is, you know, the system of whiteness,
because I'd looking over your shoulder.
English literature. Absolutely. Right. Having to constantly prove something. And so after my emotional breakdown with that question, she even said using too many words, because it's like the over explanation, which was also had to a little bit to do with spoken word. But that set me free, because then I had to say and that's why, you know, you say when you read the story, there's something familiar for you because of where you come from. So there's that cultural familiarity. If you have it, you do. If not, you don't. And you can still, you know, do the work of reading the book. So I think it really elevated the work, because I thought, hey, if I'm writing for my sister, I don't have to explain things that we both know. So, yeah.
And I do love that. I think what again, one of the things that you really feel immediately is that you resist the urge to over-translate yourself. And that comes across beautifully. It gives the text even more of that texture, even more of that feeling of being an intimate journey, you know, through this narrative.
Yeah. So thank you again to Vangi. And editors are if there's going to be sort of a, you know, if you're going to pull out a
editors are lifesavers.
Editors are lifesavers.
Yes. Thank you so much, Deepa Kazi, for this conversation. It has been an absolute wonder to read your book and to engage with this work. I have found it to be enriching and stimulating and something that I'm going to definitely be slipping into a lot of stockings for Christmas this year.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you.